morning. Right, here we go. I'm going to talk about being a disciple of Jesus in the health service. And I'm particularly going to talk about my experiences in the NHS. But I know there are various people that work in healthcare that work in the private sector as well. So I'm going to try and include them in it. So I'm going to try and answer three kind of main questions, which are: what's it like working in healthcare? What's it like being a Christian in healthcare? And if we believe God can heal, why are we working in healthcare? So I think the first question, what's it like working in healthcare? I don't know about you, but if you get in a field, regardless of what it is, a lot of what you do is kind of, it becomes your common sense, and you think that everybody else knows that kind of stuff, and actually your field can be very specialist, and there's a lot about it that people don't know. So, like, I take it for granted what it's like to work in hospital. I kind of assume that you all know, and actually a lot of you don't. So I'm going to try and cover that. And here's what it's like to work in healthcare. Yeah, this is a classic picture of NHS doctors, all super smiley, big thumbs up, having a really good time together. Yes, okay. Here's what being a doctor was like yesterday, okay? It says, this protest would be twice as big if half of us weren't on call. I think you've probably all seen it in the news, the changes that are being proposed for doctors at the moment, that they're suggesting they don't do enough hours. You know, we need to give this seven-day NHS service, and actually it's hard work being a doctor at the moment, and they're taking the opportunity to say, look, we're already trying really hard, and half of us aren't here able to protest because we're actually working. So maybe that's what it's like being a doctor at the moment. This is my favourite physio picture. Let's do some physio in the garden. I Googled working in healthcare, and that first picture of doctors came up, and this picture came up. So this is a classic Monday morning for me. Somebody I showed it to, I think it might have been Susie, said, yeah, make sure your patient puts the hat on before you start working the shoulder. And make sure you're in the garden, obviously. So, this is what it's actually like for me. This is my happy little hospital, which I love. So I work at the Queen Victoria Hospital, which is in East Grinstead, which some of you will know, I'm sure. It's only up the road. And it's a specialist hospital for burns and plastics, amongst other things. And it's world-renowned for what it does. And I don't work in that part of it at all. So I work in the outpatient physio department, which is the picture on the far right. It's not the best picture, but that's my world of plinths that I'm in Monday to Friday. And we provide what's called a community service, where we are actually serving the people of East Grinstead and the surrounding area rather than a wider kind of geographical area, which is what the burns and plastics cover, because it's so specialist. People come from far and wide. But in our little department, we just fix necks, fix backs. You know, I look out at you guys, and there's a handful of you that have had treatment from me before, which is lovely. And I think I probably fit into that stereotypical bracket of a professional masseur. You know, if people think of physio, they think, oh yeah, you just massage people all day. Chris said to me this morning, are you bringing your bed in? Are you going to do some stuff up here while we watch? But actually, if you've had treatment from me, you probably know it largely involves the use of a clever magic tape, which seems to fix everything. So I'll be available at the end if anybody wants some of that. So that's what I do. And so that's my experience of what it's like to work in healthcare, which is, I'm aware, vastly different to lots of other people. Working in outpatients, I don't deal with things like end-of-life care. I don't deal with palliative care. I don't deal with the difficult things that people often have to go to hospital for. My work is quite soft in that sense, in that it is things like necks and backs and fractures. And occasionally I'll come across the odd thing that's more upsetting, shall we say, and I will touch on that later. But for me, it could be a lot more stressful than it is. So I went out to the people of the church and beyond and said, particularly talking to Christians, what is it like for you working in healthcare? And what are your struggles, is really what I was asking. And so here's what people said. I love the opportunity my job gives me to help make a difference. I love the fact that we are walking in Jesus' footsteps. using kind hearts, kind hands, listening and helping to heal. I love that my job actually involves the task of washing people's feet. I have to say, I love that mine doesn't. Although I do have to touch people's feet on a fairly regular basis. Maybe we'll start by washing them. I love that I can be an advocate for my patients. I will go the extra mile to help them get the care they need. And I think that's a real sign of the Christian in healthcare. I struggle with wanting to do a good and thorough job caring for people, but having to rush in the time limits pressed on us. I constantly feel that I could be doing more. I came into the profession to care for people, and it's so hampered by tick box exercise admin and changes being brought in so quickly without enough time to take it all on board. Definitely agree with that one. Red tape stops me being able to help people as much as I would like. So you've got that Christian heart that you can't necessarily use it to the full because of red tape. I see miraculous healing and praise God. And the same person then said, I see no healing happen to good people and Christians, and I question why God would let this occur. It's a big one, isn't it? I find it frustrating that I cannot share my faith with my patients, even if they openly tell me they have a faith. I often pray for my patients in private. And I'm skeptical about miraculous healing. So some quite big things there, okay? So first of all, the positive side of it. I love that we are literally able to be the hands and feet of Jesus. I mean, in my job, all I do really is use my hands. And that brings healing to people. And the reading this morning that Rosemary read for us covers that. You know, if when I was sick, you healed me. When I was hungry, you gave me food. We have that opportunity to help people, and it's a privilege to do that. And I'm aware that a lot of you maybe don't have that opportunity in your jobs, so that is something to be hugely grateful for in healthcare. But the question I have is, are we doing God's work? So I was sick and you healed me, or you tended to my needs. Yes, okay, that's what we do, but is it God's work, or is it just what we do? It's just my job, it's what I'm trained to do. Do I feel that I'm called to what I do? You know, a whole day can go by at work and I haven't once thought about God. I haven't once thought about my faith. I've just gone from beginning to end and got the job done. And sometimes that can make me think I'm not called to my work, maybe, that God's not in it. We've had really interesting discussions in my house group, I don't know about you and yours, about putting the parts of our lives in different compartments, even to the degree that we're looking at it in different compartments in house group. And actually, particularly with workplace things, that's not where church fits. You know, I never come to church in my uniform, and lots of people have commented on it this morning, and that's partly, it has to be said, because of infection control. I'm not really allowed, but we won't worry about that. But it's because I'm not a physio here, and so sometimes it can feel like I'm not on the ministry team at work, but maybe that's something that I need to work on. So some of us would say that we are called into our vocations, you know, whether it's in healthcare or not. And for a long time, after I'd qualified as a physio, I felt like God had something else for me to do. I felt like physio was something I really enjoyed, and with a certain amount of work, something that I was good at. But I definitely felt like there was a bit of a hole where if I was doing something else, maybe I would feel like I was fulfilling God's purpose for me more. And you know, Ed said last week about maybe we should all be working for the church, maybe we should all be missionaries, otherwise we're not really doing God's work. What I did last year was I took the opportunity to kind of review my work and what I was doing in my job, and thought, I'm going to push some other doors and see what God has for me. And so I applied for, I thought about applying for a master's, which work we're going to fund, so to go more down the educational route and get out of the clinical job quite so much. And I also applied for Justin Welby's year out. So I don't know if you've heard about that, but he's just started a gap year for, I think it's 16 people to go and stay at Lambeth Palace for a year and basically take on like a monastic lifestyle and serve the community and live a life of prayer. And one of the questions on the application form was, how will you cope without the internet? And then I think, maybe I shouldn't be applying for this. But that came about because I was looking at Into the Masters, and then this thing popped up on Twitter about this this kind of monastery type thing. And I thought, wow, I would love to do that, way more than I'd like to do a master's. And a lot of people I spoke to were like, oh, I would hate to do that. So taking all that on board, I thought, oh, well, I'll apply. Also, I think it's a good opportunity to say, okay, God, I'm wandering along in physio. How about if you want me somewhere else? What am I doing to find that out? So I applied for this this gap year and didn't get in. And on the same day that I found out I didn't get in, the master's application closing date was that same day. And I hadn't applied for that. I'd thought about that for a long time and decided, actually, that's not what I want to do at the moment. So I pushed those doors and felt very much that they were closed. And although that was a bit sad, because it would have been amazing to go and be part of that community, I was actually okay with that. And instead, I went down the route of moving into a managerial post at work, which means I'm still doing physio stuff, but I've also got kind of a bit more responsibility. And having pushed those doors, I definitely feel like this is where God wants me to be. And so I would encourage you, regardless of what you work in or if you don't work, don't be afraid to push some doors and see, because, you know, what's the worst that can happen? You could push one of those doors and it will open into an amazing new opportunity, and that can be what God's way of showing you that's where he wants you. But equally, all those doors can stay closed, and it can be quite affirming that you are where God wants you to be. So something to bear in mind, I think. Going back to healthcare, if we're not feeling called to our vocations, I think there's still a lot of practical stuff we can do. So what I've called Good Samaritan tactics. If you look at the story of the Good Samaritan, all he did was what he could for that man that was lying in the road. And that involved just bandaging him up as much as he could and then taking him to get some help. So I think looking at the skills and the gifts that God's given you can be a really good place to start to work out what you can do to help. And then from a more Christian point of view at work, going the extra mile, so like somebody commented on being an advocate and just going the extra mile, when maybe your job description doesn't say that you need to just push that a bit further for them, but actually you've got a real heart for them and their need, and so you choose to do that, and just kind of show God's love to them in that way. And equally, praying for patients in private. I'm often praying for patients whilst I'm treating them, and often it's because I don't really know what I'm doing. So it will be a, oh, please, God, make this work, rather than a Lord, you know, bring them peace or whatever else, which I do a bit of, but I have to admit that sometimes it's like, it would be really great if you could just make this go away for them. So nothing wrong with that, hey? Yeah, there we go. So, yeah, doing God's work in the NHS. All right, frustrations is the next thing we're going to look at. So having had that really positive side of being able to be the hands and feet of Jesus, it kind of comes with frustrations. So red tape, time pressures, and not being able to share faith easily. I thought that was something that everybody was aware of, that we're not allowed to share our faith in the NHS. But as I've spoken to people over the last few weeks, I've discovered that people didn't know that. So, and a few examples of where that's been really frustrating for me. I had a lady who was struggling with back pain, and I felt at the end of the day, it boiled down to the fact that she was really lonely, and it wasn't really so much the physical pain that was the problem. It was the fact that she'd got nobody to share it with. She had a niece who had been her support in the past, and they'd actually fallen out, and she was kind of left with no sort of support network at all. And I really wanted to say to her, just go to your local church. You know, they will pick you up and help you out. She'd got problems with debt that she was worrying about and this, that, and the other. And it's like, there's so much out there that the church can offer you. And, you know, the smallest of those things is that they'll provide you with some friends. And I couldn't do that. Technically, my job doesn't allow that to happen. So that's really hard. And equally, you see patients who are in really difficult situations, and you know, I end up saying, fingers crossed, which is horrible, isn't it, really? Because, you know, that's not what we believe at all. We don't believe in luck, and you want to be able to say to them, I'll be praying for you, whatever. So, red tape first, though. Oh, it doesn't quite fit on the screen, that's a shame. Here are some things that I would put under red tape. So, safeguarding issues. You know, you want to go the extra mile and help people who have got children in trouble or whatever else, but actually there's a large amount of red tape there that stops you from doing that. You have to just pass the case on to somebody else and let them deal with it. Targets and outcome measures, cost effectiveness. You know, how well are we doing our job? I'd love to spend more time with each of my patients, but that's not possible because there's a huge waiting list. Trust policy and access to onward referrals. So whether you can actually send people to the places that they need to go. And I think there's a real case for church being a place of onward referral, you know, that from the hospital that we could refer to a local church or some kind of organisation like that. And then into sharing faith with colleagues even. I don't know if anybody recognises this lady. Her name is Victoria Wasteny, and she's an occupational therapist up in Derbyshire. And in April of this year, she was suspended from work because she shared her faith with a Muslim colleague. They basically had a conversation and she said about praying for her, and then the lady, the colleague, went and put in a complaint against her, and they took it up as bullying and harassment. So even with your colleagues, you've got to be really careful. I think in my team, I'm really lucky. On Friday, we had a really interesting conversation over lunchtime where we did the usual, what are you doing this weekend? And I actually said, oh, well, I'm speaking at church, as it happens. And they're a really nice group, and they're really open to that kind of thing. So we had some really good conversations about what we think about that. And Angie's one of my colleagues who's here this morning, and she and I were kind of taking the Christian side. And it wasn't like it was one us versus them at all, but it was just a really good opportunity to kind of unpack some of those things. But I'm hugely aware that lots of people don't have that opportunity in their workplace. Equally, I think sharing faith with patients is really hard, especially when you know they're a Christian. So I've got two patients at the moment who I think they're Christians because they go to the church that one of our other physios goes to. So I've heard from that physio that they're in the church, and I've not had the conversation with the patients themselves. So I can't access that because they haven't brought it up. So I know that they've got some faith, but it doesn't get mentioned. One of them is an 18-year-old with terminal cancer, which is horrible, isn't it? And I've been seeing him for a couple of years. And I didn't know he was a Christian. And we thought that he'd beaten it until about 2 months ago. And, you know, I just think, what do we do with that? And I ummed and ahed about going back to this physio and saying, If he's in your church, can you ask him if I can pray? Can you ask him if we can pray? But I think the main thing is, God knows, doesn't he? God knows who that guy is, and he knows that church, and he knows, I don't need to give you that guy's details, but you can pray for him now. And then, amazingly, in the same church, which is how I know about it, there's a man whose wife's got a brain tumour and is probably going to die in the next month or so. And he's coming in for physio for a fractured ankle. I knew this was going to happen. I saw him the first time he came in, and he brought his wife with him because she was having chemo and was really confused. So he couldn't leave her, so he brought her along. And so we'd kind of touched on what was going on with her at the beginning. And then I actually passed her over to Angie because my diary had just got a bit ridiculous. And she's carried on seeing him. And she had the most amazing conversation with him the other day about the fact that his wife's now in, you know, the last stage of her life. And they've only been married 18 months. But she's got three children from a previous marriage and three boys. And he said to her, to Angie, you know, the church has been amazing. I don't know where we would be without the prayers of the church. And he asked her if she was a Christian. So she said, yeah, I am, but I'm not really allowed to talk about it. Which is true. So, you know, but actually his response, the light in his eyes suddenly from that knowledge that actually you're in good company, you know, is an amazing thing. And And then she told him that I was as well. And he was just like, that's amazing that you've got colleagues, you know, that share that faith. And it's a real bridge builder, isn't it? And I said to Andrew, you know what? Probably just having that conversation with him did as much good for his health as all the physio that you've done on his ankle, because it's just touched another part of his life and given him a bit more hope in those dark places. So now onto something a little bit less emotional, but we'll come back to the emotional side of things. A quick history lesson about the origin of healthcare. So, I don't know who knows about the origin of healthcare, but I didn't until I looked into it. Hospitals and hospices, like all these things, I think they're a big part of our community and our lifestyle. But you don't really think about where they came from. Like, I often think about, who on earth discovered bread? You know? Like, somebody thought, if we put this with this and mix it all together and stick it in the oven, and suddenly, you know, it's like all those things. And hospitals are no different. Somebody thought, first of all, right, we need to put these people that are ill together and try and sort them out. Maybe not so much of a mystery as bread, but, you know. So the Old Testament's got some interesting stuff in about healthcare in terms of Leviticus and, like, the rules around washing and sacrifices, and if somebody's sick, then they have to be put outside the community and all this sort of thing. You can see that a lot of that is just really sensible hygiene advice from God. And actually, in the very early Christian times, it was noticed that their kind of ethics and their way of working was actually quite sensible in terms of having healthy populations. And a lot of that was taken on board by Roman emperors. And then their kind of healthcare system was established. And then in the year 369, St. Basil of Caesarea founded a significant hospital for plague and leprosy patients. So there's your kind of first hospitals coming in. And in Britain, a number of monastic buildings were established. But at that time, so it was very much came out of the church, and at that time they recognised that the health of the body and the soul are very much together. Okay? And then in 1948, this happened. The NHS came along, and as wonderful as it is, you know, people that I speak to that have worked and lived abroad say they can't fault the NHS in that respect. If you go somewhere that doesn't have it, you are so grateful for it. And I think it's easy for us to forget that, isn't it? So the NHS came along, and they now come at healthcare from a biopsychosocial approach, which is a bit jargony, isn't it? But that's basically where you've got the biology of healthcare and the psychology of healthcare with a social element, but there's no spiritual element. Other things that are mentioned in healthcare are things like psychosomatic medicine, so very much things of the mind. And then outside of the NHS, you've got your complementary, alternative, holistic kind of medicine, which has definitely got a spiritual element to it. One of the things I practice is acupuncture, and that can be a really interesting conversation starter with people in church because they're not sure what to think about it. Is it kind of witch science or, you know, whatever? But I can give you a very valid Western explanation of how it works if you want one. I won't do that now. So, spiritual health. They've kind of left out the NHS and said, yeah, okay, it can go into alternative medicine, it can go into the church. And is there then a link between these elements? This is what I feel like the link is like. There's a bridge that one side is healthcare, the other side is church, and they come together, but they don't quite meet in the middle. You know, particularly with those frustrations of things like not being able to share our faith, even though we're Christians in those roles. The bridge is there, but it's not quite complete, and it actually doesn't match up. Okay, and now I'm going to move on to something that I think is the biggest tension for me in healthcare. I'm aware of the time, so I'm going to have to get a move on. And that is miraculous physical healing. Okay. It was mentioned at the beginning as one of the issues, and I think it's definitely something that's difficult to kind of broach from a healthcare perspective. Interestingly, on the Friday that we had the discussion at work about it, somebody said, if it was a given that God was going to answer those prayers, then we would pray for money and stuff, wouldn't we? And isn't actually that really true? That, you know, if we knew that God was going to heal, if we put physical illness purely down to prayer, then we would pray for everything and God would provide everything and there would be no faith required because God would just give us what we asked for. So we're going to look at that kind of tension. And at the risk of getting emotional again, I'm just going to read from Philip Yancey's book, Prayer, Does It Make Any Difference? Okay. When asked to speak at my church on the topic, what I have learned about suffering, I went to a filing cabinet drawer and pulled out the thick folder of letters I've received in response to my books on suffering. On Sunday, I set the letters on a table on stage beside me. They made a large pile, perhaps 1,000 letters in all, each one representing a story, usually a tragic story, most of them asking poignant questions about physical healing. One of the letters comes from a couple who were leaders in their church. In 1991, their 21-year-old son, a scholarship athlete and youth leader in the church, fell asleep at the wheel while driving. The accident severed his aorta and caused paralysis from the waist down. 30,000 people in the close-knit community prayed for divine healing. Elders anointed him with oil, and a national television minister prayed over him. 15 years later, the young man is still paralyzed. Where was the answered prayer that I longed to share with my friends, writes the mother. Where was the Father in heaven who sees the sparrow that falls and loves my son even more than I? The Father minces no words. What is the value of prayer, he asks. And that chapter goes on and talks about different awful things that are physical illnesses that occur in this world that people haven't received healing for. And not only that, but also the fact that some do and some don't is a huge tension, isn't it? Who decides? Obviously God decides, but, you know, what decides who does get that healing and who doesn't? So I'm just going to look at what I've read around on that and what I think about that, okay? But I'm aware that there's a big disclaimer with that I don't have all the answers and that my view isn't necessarily the right one, and there will be people here that may not agree with what I'm going to say, and that's absolutely fine. So first of all, if we're going to look at whether miracles happen, we need to look at what miracles are. So category one, miracles, we're going to put it into three different things. An extraordinary and welcome event that is not explicable by natural or scientific laws and is therefore attributed to a divine agency. And category two and three, a remarkable event or development that brings very welcome consequences. Or an exceptional product or achievement or an outstanding example of something. Okay. And then quickly, hallmarks from the New Testament. There are obviously miraculous healings in the New Testament that we've seen that are documented, and they tend to fulfill these criteria. They're conditions that were examples of gross physical disease. At the time, they were incurable, and some of them are still incurable today. Cures were immediate. Restoration was complete and was therefore obvious, and there were no recorded relapses. So that's what we're looking at when we're talking about miracles. I believe that God can heal in a miraculous way, and I don't want to put a damper on that at all. But the scientist in me doesn't get how that works. Okay? There's definitely the inbuilt miracle of healing. It's incredible, isn't it, that you cut yourself and it sorts itself out, it heals itself, and you don't even have to think about it. But equally, suffering is much in our design, I think, as healing is. It seems to be inevitable. And C.S. Lewis says, try to exclude the possibility of suffering which the order of nature and the existence of free wills involve, and you have found that you excluded life itself. So can we assess miraculous claims? As a scientist, I want to be able to put that experiment in a box and really look at it under the magnifying glass and see what the results are. So this is another thing that my colleague brought up, actually, was, what about the medical side of the story? You know, people have got that, oh, I had this, that, and the other, and I got prayer, and I was miraculously healed. But actually, what we would say in medicine is, what was the medical version of the story? Was there a definite diagnosis? How reliable were the tests performed? And was treatment being given at the time of the healing? All things that make us a little bit more skeptical. An interesting example of this is a man who has a headache, and he goes to the GP, and the GP has a look at him and says, oh gosh, I think you might have a bleed on the brain. Let's quickly send you off to hospital. So obviously that's a bit scary, isn't it? The man gets in touch with his church and says, oh my goodness, I've got a bleed on the brain. Please can you pray? I'm off to the hospital now to get scanned. Goes and has a scan. There's no bleed on the brain. Answer to prayer, miraculous recovery, or actually is it just that he never had a bleed on the brain? That was just what the doctor thought it might have been, and the test ruled it out, okay? One example of where, in medicine, we would say, it wasn't a miracle. And so I've looked at other people who've got a lot more knowledge and wisdom than I have, who have looked into this as well. So one's a guy called Andrew Ferguson, who's a GP, or was a GP, and then was a leader of the Christian Medical Fellowship. And he looked into miracles with some of his colleagues about 15 years ago. And they said they found lots of signs and wonders, but no Category 1 miracles. And Dr. Paul Brand is a surgeon who has worked with Philip Yancey and who he talks about in this book. And they wrote an article together for Christianity Today. And he said, "From my experience as a physician, I must truthfully admit that among the thousands of patients I've treated, I've never observed an unequivocal instance of intervention in the physical realm. Many were prayed for, many found healing, but not in ways that counteracted the laws governing anatomy. No case I've treated personally would meet the rigorous criteria for a supernatural miracle." And Lourdes, the little town in France where there have been lots of claims of miraculous healing, their medical board looked at 7,000 claims of healing across 2 centuries and only found 67 that were classed as miracles, and only one of those since 1987. So you're starting to get the picture that actually, whilst we believe in a God who can perform miracles and physically heal people, that it's not really happening as much as we would like. Harold Koenig has written a book. He's a psychiatrist who is involved with Duke University and Harvard for the study of religion and spirituality and health. And he's written a book about the healing powers of faith, which admittedly isn't necessarily about prayer, but it's about faith and the difference that faith has in healthcare. And he covers a lot of different areas in the book about things like, if you have faith, you will live longer. If you have faith, you will have fewer hospital appointments. You will recover quicker, all these kinds of things. But he does admit that that's not down to prayer necessarily, but that's down to having a faith and having some kind of support network and system that you believe in that will help with your health. And then in 2009, the Cochrane Review was of intercessory prayer for the alleviation of ill health. So the Cochrane organisation look at all the evidence for something and then kind of produce one document, which we then use in healthcare to provide the most helpful things, I guess. And this is what they said. These findings are equivocal, and although some of the results of individual studies suggest a positive effect of intercessory prayer, the majority do not, and the evidence does not support a recommendation either in favour or against the use of intercessory prayer. And then this bit's interesting, I think. We are not convinced that further trials of this intervention should be undertaken and would prefer to see any resources available for such a trial used to investigate other questions. That's quite strong, isn't it? That's quite a strong opinion. That's not just a lot of what we get in physio is there's not enough evidence. And then the following statement is, more needs to be done. But actually, for some reason with this, they've said, we don't think this is a good idea. And from a Christian point of view, I think, in a way, you could also say, this is not a good idea, because technically we're testing God, aren't we, on this? And the Bible says that we shouldn't do that. Deuteronomy 6:16 says, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And when Satan is tempting Jesus in the desert, in Luke 4:12, it says, do not put God to the test. So potentially you could argue that actually God's going to make a point of not healing those people, maybe. There is also something called spontaneous regression, which is where people spontaneously get better. So the American College of Surgeons recognises 176 cases of cancer spontaneously cured. And there's lots of other literature with similar findings. Some of those people had prayer, some didn't. Two to three out of every 1,000 cases are suddenly going to get better. So why am I telling you all this? I personally find that very encouraging. I work in healthcare where there's this huge tension, and actually what we're seeing is that Category 1 miracles aren't taking place. And that doesn't mean that God doesn't love us, does it? God still loves us, and it's not our fault if we don't get healed or cured, because that's not necessarily the point. Okay, and I think a key point is we don't have to put on a brave face because we found Jesus. We don't have to think, yeah, we believe in this God that heals, and so therefore we've got to stick with that to the very end. Actually, church is the place where we should be able to be the most broken about the fact that we haven't found healing. You know, Suzanne talked a while back about the road to Emmaus, where those people are having that conversation before they know that Jesus is risen, and actually they're right down in the depths of it, and that should be where you can come into the church and you can find healing through support. So perhaps, I'm going to have to hurry up, aren't I? My problem is that I want God to be more systematic. You know, if I've learnt anything this year, it's that if I make a plan and then I give it to God, My plan's never going to be what happens. God's always got a different way of looking at it and a different way of doing things. And so trying to be systematic probably just isn't going to work. But we understand life in human terms. We want God to be fair. We want everybody to get healed or nobody to get healed, I suppose, and that's not what happens. And we can't understand that if God does love us, why he wouldn't do that. And sometimes I think we can also confuse healing and cure. You know, we think cure is the only option, really, but actually God might be working in different ways. You may not have that physical healing, but actually how else is he working in your life through that prayer? I'm also going to just look at 1 Corinthians as we kind of come to an end. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. And I'm just going to look at earlier on in that chapter and the previous chapter. So 1 Corinthians 12 talks about how we've all got our role to play in the body of Christ. And that no one person's job is more important than the other. And then the early part of chapter 13 says, if I speak in tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I'm only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. I have the gifts of prophecy and can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge. And I have a faith that I can move mountains, but I don't have love, then I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast, but do not have love, I gain nothing. And then there's that famous passage about love is patient, love is kind. And it's interesting, isn't it, that those two come together. There's all that about how important love is, and then it follows on with, we won't fully know what this is all about. But the main thing is that we hang on. We have faith, hope, and love. So all we're asked to do is hang on in there. Keep believing in that God that we know can heal, even if he doesn't. Keep hoping and praying. You know, it's important that we still ask for those things, that we specifically give those requests to God, because he wants to hear our cries. He wants us to talk to him about those things rather than think, right, well, we know that he's probably not going to do this, so let's not bother. And we need to love one another. And then there's this interesting phrase that I got from somewhere that's, don't just do something, stand there. Okay, we have the opposite, don't we, that kind of approach to things where we want to make things better, and actually sometimes the best thing you can do for someone is just stand there, just be there for them. You know, that boy that's got cancer, I can't fix it, but I can be there. I can, even if I don't share my faith with him, I can still show him that love that God has for him. And then finally, remember that God is a co-sufferer with us. You know, you look at the Psalms. Psalm 22 and Psalm 23 are together. Psalm 22 is, my God, why have you forsaken me? And Psalm 23 is, the Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. The end of the chapter in here that's on physical healing, I was going to read, but I won't now, talks about a guy with motor neuron disease and his family's journey through the illness and then to the end of his life. And that's what they refer to. Those two psalms, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then coming to a place of peace where they say, the Lord is my shepherd, I lack nothing. I'm going to finish with a little excerpt from The Magician's Nephew. You can't go wrong with a bit of Narnia, can you? So for those of you that haven't read The Magician's Nephew, it's about a boy called Diggory, whose mother is very ill. And for one reason or another, he ends up finding the White Witch first in the world Charn, and then unfortunately taking her into Narnia just as Aslan is creating Narnia. And so he's in a bit of trouble, really, because he's brought this witch in who into this perfect world. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And he watches Aslan create the world, he sees, a bit like we would see in God, somebody who can do amazing things, who can take, you know, apples and make them into these incredible trees. And the lamppost that's in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe comes from The Magician's Nephew, where the White Witch has brought in part of a lamppost because she's going around rampaging the place. And it turns into this amazing lamppost, which you then see later on. So he sees all of that and he thinks, I'm sure he can do something to heal my mother. And this is when he finally speaks to Aslan about it. Diggory kept his mouth very tight shut. He'd been growing more and more uncomfortable. He'd hoped that, whatever happened, he wouldn't blub or do anything ridiculous. Son of Adam, said Aslan, are you ready to undo the wrong that you have done to my sweet country of Narnia on the day of its birth? Well, I don't see what I can do, said Diggory. You see, the queen ran away and I asked, are you ready, said the lion. Yes, said Diggory. He had had for a second some wild idea of saying, I'll try to help you if you'll promise to help my mother. But he realised in time that the lion was not at all the sort of person one could try to make bargains with. But when he had said yes, he thought of his mother. And he thought of the great hopes he'd had and how they were all dying away. And a lump came into his throat and tears in his eyes. And he blurted out, but please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure mother? Up until then, he'd been looking at the lion's great feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at its face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life, for the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself. Let's pray. Lord, I thank you for the miracle of healing and the amazing inbuilt miracle that we have in each of our bodies to repair themselves, Lord. And I thank you that we are such a great example of how able you are. And Lord, I just lift up this difficult area of healing that we don't fully understand and ask that you would just help us to hold on to those things, that faith, that hope, and that love, Lord, that we would be able to keep being the hands and feet of Jesus to each other. And I just ask that you would help us wherever we work to be able to show your love as well, Lord. For at the end of the day, that is the greatest thing that we must hang on to. Amen.